real people dealing with real struggles. Well, tonight I want us to go to that short story of Ruth and ask that question. What do we learn about God in the book of Ruth? What do we learn about His provisions? And again, when we read the story, it's easy to give attention to the detail we see there with regard to the struggles of a woman named Naomi, a widow in a foreign land, and her two daughter-in-laws, and the struggle that they were experiencing at a time of famine and a time of grief. And that is certainly a big part of the reason why we get the story of Ruth. But it's more than just the story of Naomi or Ruth or Orpah or Boaz. This is the story of a people who are very much struggling with their identity, their relationship with God, and how God was continuing to preserve His plan despite the sinful efforts of His people. And it's also our story. Ruth touches our story in a direct way. And we, of course, are familiar with the genealogy of Jesus. But I think in addition to that reality, Ruth being a part of that ancestry, we also see the character of God exemplified in her life that will hopefully encourage us tonight as we reflect on this story together. And I believe that as we read the narrative of Ruth and as we ask that question, how's Ruth's life impacted by God's faithfulness? How's Israel impacted by God's faithfulness? How are we impacted as we read this story with regard to God's faithfulness? We also have another question we've got to struggle with, and it's the question of, will God act even when the circumstances are less than favorable? Sometimes I think even in our world, when we're experiencing suffering, and our first response is, God, why is this happening to me? Why am I the one experiencing this heartache or hardship? Don't you know that I've tried to be faithful? I've tried to obey your will. I've tried to walk in the light, as we sometimes say. Why am I the one? Why my family? Why my experience? Are you going to be there? Are you going to be faithful when my circumstances are less than ideal? We see that the story of Ruth is set in an unusual place. We see this throughout Scripture. It's interesting to me that the two books in the Old Testament that are named after women of faith are both set in periods in which God's people are in a world of trouble. Ruth is set in the period of the judges. We get that in the very first verse of this short book. Esther is set in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. You'll remember what is going on when they're in Persian captivity, and by the grace of God, under rulers like Cyrus, we see God's people being allowed to return and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, the temple there, and reinstitute their lives. God's faithful even in those periods of exile, maybe even like the prophet Jonah, who sent by God to the land of Assyria, to the capital of that empire, the city of Nineveh. And his job is to preach God's love to a group of people who've demonstrated nothing but hate. And I think that's part of the reason, at least, why Jonah was very reluctant to be there. And so this story, for the most part, at least the first chapter, and Ruth's story is set in the land of Moab. Now, when we think about what happens in the development of the nation of Moab, it's an odd thing to see God at work in that territory. Most people who lived in antiquity believed that their gods were limited to a certain territory. If you left the regions of that land, that God was no longer with you. And it's amazing to read the Old Testament and see that whether the people of God are in Egypt or in Assyria or Babylon or wherever they might be, even in the wilderness, God is there and God is faithful. But this story, the story of Ruth, is set at a time that is very discouraging for the people of God. And really, they have every reason, God's people have every reason to doubt that He is present, that He cares, that He's going to redeem them in any way. Now, as we talked about last Sunday night, in the period of the judges, it's really their own fault. That's the fact that God brought them out of Egypt and gave them a land and equipped them with the opportunity by His own gracious goodwill to allow them to be faithful in covenant with Him. And again, we see Israel fail to live that out. But just in the first chapter of Ruth, we see every reason, at least foreseeably, if we're walking by sight rather than faith, that these people would have thought, you know what, God doesn't provide. And I wanted to start there because I think it might be the case that some of us hear those words, God provides, and maybe we think about other people. Yeah, He provides for them very clearly, but He doesn't provide for me. At least He doesn't give me what I've been asking for a long time. Where is God? Why is He not working in my life in the way that I think He ought to be working? Well, notice all the reasons why readers of Ruth would see her at a great disadvantage. First of all, we read in the very first verse, it's in the days when the judges governed. And if we've read the previous book, if we've reflected on the fact that Judges 17:6, 21:25 both recall the reality that everybody did what was right in their own eyes. There was no king in Israel in the time of the judges. And even that some of those men, and even Deborah to some extent, were not always faithful to God's covenant. They were not always there. They were not always present. They were not always willing to give God the glory. That alone shows you that we're talking about a period of time that was very difficult for God's people. Some would say that the period of the judges is the darkest period other than exile in all the Old Testament. And perhaps the story of Ruth is a reminder that even when people are doing terrible things and failing to see God's goodness, God's still at work. And perhaps even God's at work in ways we would never expect, we would never anticipate. Paul reflects on that at the beginning of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23, when he talks about the foolishness of the cross, how God, really in the first three chapters of 1 Corinthians, you've got a divided church following their favorite teachers. And again, God calls through Paul those people back to the reality that God has a will and a plan that is greater than anything we can see, greater even than anything we can perceive. Here's a group of people who have every reason to doubt that anything good could be happening in the period of the judges. And maybe even as readers of Scripture, we work our way through the Old Testament, we get through the book of Judges, we think, whew, how could God in any way get this ox out of the ditch? How could he redeem this people that he made promises to all the way back to the father Abraham? But now we see, in a very unexpected way, in a foreign land, using a foreign woman, in a disadvantaged situation, three widows in that foreign territory being used by God in incredible ways. We see the fact that there is a famine, and if we know the story of Judges, we know that the reason there's a famine in the land, according to verse 1, is because of Israel's sin. Now, that's not to say that there's a drought later this summer. It's because we've somehow failed to do God's will. But there's a strong connection, at least in the Old Testament, between the land of promise, the fruit of that land, the rain, all the other blessings that would come with that literal territory that Israel had inherited, and their faithfulness. Ironically, the famine results from Israel's sin. And here you have a man whose name means, "My God is King," Elimelech, and his wife, Naomi, whose name means sweetness, living that life. They're in Bethlehem of Judah. They have a great family, at least it appears. They have every reason to give thanks. These two boys are growing, and this famine comes along, and they leave that land. Now, there are some good moments where Israel and the Moabites interact with one another in the Old Testament, but if you'll go back to that tragic story of Lot and his daughters, it's not a chapter we like to look at very much because the details there are really difficult and there are some awful things that happen in Sodom and Gomorrah. But you might remember that it was because of a sinful union between Lot and one of his daughters in Genesis 19, verse 37, that you have the Moabites come about. And I'm not suggesting that the story of Ruth necessarily intends to call us back to that circumstance, but it's ironic that here you have a man taking his wife and two sons to a land that is known for paganism out of desperation because of a famine that has impacted Palestine as a result of Israel's sin. They get there, and at first glance, things are going fine. You have a difficult situation where Mahlon and Chilion, the sons of Elimelech and Naomi, take foreign wives. There are prohibitions in the covenant about intermarrying with other groups, and yet we see God bless this union despite the fact that you have a difficult circumstance that comes about. Not only is there intermarrying with these Moabite women, but you also have the fact that Elimelech dies. Now, Naomi still has two sons who have wives, but those sons die. And so not only now has there been a famine and are we in a foreign territory, but we have three women, the older woman, Naomi, and her two young daughter-in-laws, who are now all three widows. And of course, Naomi feels forsaken. Her name means sweetness, but it's interesting that as you read the story of Ruth, especially chapter 1, you see her repeatedly make reference to the fact that she feels like God has forsaken her. God has forgotten her. Look at verse 13, if you will, of Ruth chapter 1. See what she says there about the fact that, yeah, verse 12, I'm an older woman, I have no husband. Maybe you all would have an opportunity to go on with your lives. This is where she's encouraging Orpah and Naomi to go back to their fathers and to remarry and seek out other opportunities. And we know that Orpah, who's mentioned for the last time in this chapter, takes advantage of that opportunity. But notice what Naomi says in that setting. Ruth chapter 1, verse 13. No, my daughter, it's harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. Why would Naomi think that? Well, there's been a famine. We left the land that we were blessed in, where I had the name Sweetness. We came to this territory, and despite the initial blessings we experienced here, my husband's dead, my two sons are dead, and now I am desperate for help, and all my family's back in Bethlehem. The Lord has done evil things to me. He has not blessed me in the ways that I expected. And as they weep and continue to reflect on this reality, she goes even further. When she gets back to Bethlehem, of course, we know that beautiful story, how Ruth speaks so wonderfully to her. And I don't know that there's a more beautiful passage in all of Scripture, arguably, than what Ruth says to Naomi, the friendship and the love and the kinship they show towards one another, starting in verse 16 down through verse 17. But notice that when Naomi gets back to Bethlehem, this awful experience in Moab has obviously impacted her, not only psychologically and spiritually, but also physically. Those women who knew her back in Bethlehem before she and Elimelech and their family went to Moab as a result of the famine, they see her, and what do they ask in verse 19? I'm celebrating a birthday this week. It has a zero at the end of it. I posted a picture recently, and somebody commented and said, is this the same person I went to school with? I took the picture down, right? So as Naomi comes back into town, they say, is this Naomi? This can't be the same person. And notice what Naomi says in verse 20. Don't call me Naomi. Now, we know what Naomi's name means, right? Sweetness, one who's been blessed, one who's been given opportunity. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. Maybe you have a footnote there that tells you that Mara means bitter, the opposite of sweetness. My name shouldn't be Sweetness. It should be bitter because of all the terrible experiences that I've had. And she even spells that out in verse 20. The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. So why call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So you see that there's every reason, at least in Ruth chapter 1, the inspired writer of this brief book sets the stage for us with every expectation that because of the historical setting, because we're in a foreign territory, because we're living at a time where a lot of women would have been dependent upon their fathers or their husbands in that social context to have provided for them. Widows and orphans would have been very vulnerable in this cultural setting. There are all kinds of reasons to think that God has given up on Naomi and her family, and there's no reason to anticipate or expect a blessing. But that's where the story of Ruth shifts. And it's easy for us as we read these brief chapters again to think about Boaz as the kinsman redeemer. It's kind of a foreign concept to us, but Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 5, talks about as Moses repeats the law, as the children of Israel are anticipating entering to the land of Canaan, that if your brother's wife were to die, or I'm sorry, if your sister-in-law's husband, your brother, were to die, and they had no children, it would be your obligation to marry her, and the first child would bear the name of your brother's name so that his family line could pass on. And the reason that matters is God drew the boundaries of the territory. He set the tribes in order. That tribal inheritance every 50 years as a part of the year of Jubilee would go back to the rightful owner as assigned by God. So it's not just the joy of having children. It's tied to your lineage. It's tied to your inheritance. It's a sign of God's blessing. So we see the role that Boaz plays in this book in chapter 2 by graciously offering the gleanings of his field for Ruth to gather those things. Of course, she's industrious. She's a hard worker. She's devoted to God. She's devoted to her mother-in-law. She's devoted to Boaz in many ways. We see that work, but were it not for the provision God made in the law, that the gleanings of the field be left for the poor, that probably wouldn't have happened. And then in chapter 3, were it not for the provisions of the law that there be a kinsman redeemer, it probably wouldn't have been the case that Boaz in chapter 4 could go. And when the rightful kinsman redeemer says, you know, I can't fulfill that obligation. If I do so, I might lose my inheritance. He has an opportunity to marry her and to provide for her. And so it's easy to get distracted by all the details. And that's one of the things when you read commentaries on Ruth, people talk about, well, maybe Ruth's in the Bible because of the genealogy at the end. Because at the very end of chapter 4, we find out that Ruth is the great-grandmother of King David. Maybe that's the reason Ruth's in the Bible. Or maybe Ruth's in the Bible to remind Israel of the importance of the law of the kinsman redeemer or the gleanings of the field, and that God really does care for the widows and the orphans. And if you want an illustration of that, look no further than the book of Ruth. And it's possible that those are things that we might look at. We might look at the fact that the word return occurs so frequently in this book, especially the first two chapters, as a way of reminding all of God's people that he had blessed them with an inheritance. And even though they were being wicked in that period of the judges, he was preserving them and honoring them and continuing to bless them. But with all of those things being considered, I still would recommend that the greatest reason Ruth is in our Bible is because it speaks to the faithfulness of God. It speaks to the fact that God continues to work in our best interest even when we fail. Now, his covenant is conditional. And this is not universalism. We understand from what Jesus says in Matthew 7 that there are consequences for our actions. And unfortunately, the way that leads to destruction is wide and easy. But we have a God who desires a right standing with us. And as you think about Ruth, it's a ripple effect, concentric circles that show the way that God blessing one individual would impact other individuals. And by the end of the story of Ruth, we find out that we've all been touched by God's careful and powerful provision for us that we did not ask for and that we do not deserve. Let's consider quickly five circles of God's providence in the book of Ruth. I promise I'm going to make this quick. We'll be out in at least 3 hours. Okay, first, notice that was a joke. Somebody just got and left. Notice the way that Elimelech, for example, and his family are blessed. It's easy sometimes to overlook this because in the first five verses, the circumstances are so tragic in the fact that there's a famine and there's this pilgrimage and you have three men die that it's easy to miss out on the fact that God did not have to feed these people. These were people who were of the covenant people of God. And the covenant of God said, if you're faithful, you'll be blessed. If you're faithful, your crops will grow. If you're faithful, you'll get the rain you need. If you're faithful, you'll be able to stay in the land. And we know from the story of the Old Testament that the exile into Assyria and into Babylon and all the things that befall the Israelites in the Old Testament are a result of their failure to depend on God. And despite that, despite the intermarrying we see here, despite the continuous accusations, at least in chapter 1. Now, we're going to see that Naomi changes her tune when she seeks to recognize what some of the other women in Bethlehem recognize, that God really is blessing her, that he is still present with her. And it takes time. It's easy to pick on her, but she's going to recognize with time and perspective that God is very much at work in her life. But that starts with a good family. From all appearances, a family that still sought God's blessing. And despite their failure as a part of the people of Israel, they survived the famine. They are blessed in a foreign land. God didn't tell them to go to that land. God didn't tell them to intermarry. There is every reason to look at this family with suspicion and to say, you don't deserve God's blessings, but God provided for them anyway. Not saying God was pleased with their choices. Not suggesting that God commissioned them to act in this way. But God blessed them in the midst of that famine. And then more specifically, he blesses Naomi. Even as a widow, even as someone that we've already read at the end of chapter 1, was struggling with God's presence in her life, was struggling with God's justness, as we talked about last week. You see in, for example, Ruth chapter 2, verse 20, after they've encountered Boaz, this relative of Elimelech, who very kindly is allowing them to basically survive on the gleanings of the field, and he's feeding Ruth, and she's taking provisions back to Naomi, and Naomi very quickly recognizes that this is God. This is God's activity. She starts to recognize that her name really does have meaning as one who has sweetness in the Lord. When she says to Ruth in Ruth chapter 2, verse 20, "May he," talking about Boaz, "be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." Why does she say that? Because she recognizes that by loving Ruth and providing for her, Naomi, he has also found endearment with his dead relative, Elimelech, not only because he's living up to the standard of Deuteronomy 25, but because he truly is showing the love of God, even the way he treats his reapers. We could spend a lot of time looking at the example of Boaz. I fear that in doing so sometimes we fail to see that God is the real hero of the story. But even in Ruth chapter 2, verse 4, when Boaz comes from Bethlehem, notice how he addressed his reapers. Not, "Hey, why are you standing around? Get back to work. You're not going to be paid unless you get back in the field." No, his response is, "May the Lord be with you." And they said, you know, they're treated well. They're not just offering flattery to their employer. When they say in Ruth 2, verse 4, "May the Lord bless you." And when he discovers who Ruth is, through Ruth, he blesses Naomi in tremendous ways. And by the end of the story, when Ruth and Boaz are blessed with a child, Obed, we see the way that the women of Bethlehem immediately recognize that God was continuing to bless them. And that's one of the reasons why this child is named Obed. When Boaz marries Ruth and they have this child, the women, Ruth chapter 4, verse 14 of Bethlehem, say to Naomi, say to the same woman, widowed in chapter 1, with every reason to accuse God of not blessing her in the ways that she thought she should be blessed, of not providing for her, the women said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord, who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than seven sons who has given birth to him." Those women in Judah, in a time that the judges reigned and many people failed to see God's goodness, saw God's goodness in this situation. And arguably, God doesn't just bless Naomi in this difficult time, he blesses others through Naomi. Sometimes I think we focus on the jealousy that can be provoked because people see our blessings and they want that. They wonder why those blessings might not be in their lives. We might look at others and feel that same way. But there's also the benefit of our good works causing other people to glorify our Father who's in heaven. Of our blessings, if we give God the credit, if we praise our God and say that despite our iniquity, despite the fact we don't deserve those blessings, God is good. That bears witness to the faithfulness of God as the one who provides for us and sustains us. We've already made it clear that God provides for Ruth. That's really what the whole book is about. And you could argue that the whole book, especially chapters 2 through 4, is about God's provisions for Ruth. But I think that's short-sighted. Because Ruth, even though she is faithful and she is a blessing and a heroine of faith, she is a conduit through which we are all blessed. She is one who is interested in serving her mother-in-law, but because of her selfless spirit, she ends up serving all of us. I love the reference in Ruth chapter 2, verse 11. When Boaz finds out that she's been sitting there all day, waiting on the work to be done so that she could take some of the gleanings of the field, Boaz looks at her and says, "All that you have done." This is in response to her saying, "I don't deserve your love. I'm a foreigner. I don't deserve to be treated this way." In humility, he says to her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me. How you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know." So it's interesting that Naomi is struggling with this situation and crying out to God, "Why aren't you blessing me? Why aren't you giving me the sweetness that I've been blessed with my whole life?" And in contrast, you have a Moabitess, someone who had no reason, no foundation, no roots, other than perhaps seeing the way that God had worked in this family's life, demonstrating faithfulness and love. And in that same setting that we just read from in Ruth chapter 4, where The women look at Naomi and say, "You are blessed. Blessed be the God for the way that he's worked in your life." As you come to the end of the story of Ruth, especially Ruth chapter 4, verses 9 through 13, you see the way that Boaz redeems her, they marry, and the people who are in the court, much like the women who look at Naomi and say, "God has blessed you," all the people, we're talking about the period of the judges, where there's so little to be thankful for with regard to the faithfulness of the Israelites. All the people who were in the court, verse 11, Ruth chapter 4, and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman." The Lord enabled her, verse 13, to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And that's when the women look at Naomi and say, because of what we've seen God do in this situation, we know he's blessed you. One of the favorite features of Bible study is to think about, especially in the stories of the Old Testament, not only how God blesses individuals like Ruth and Naomi, but how he blesses his entire people, and how through blessing the people of Israel by the promises made and fulfilled in our Lord Jesus, he blesses all of us. Consider the way that God's provision impacts Israel. Now, this is evident throughout the book if we're familiar with the setting of Joshua and Judges, how we've gone from the conquest of Canaan to the unrest of Judges because of the disobedience of God's people to God's covenant. But when you go to the very end of this book, after Obed is born, after Ruth and Boaz have been blessed with this child, notice what happens. Almost akin to what happens in the story of Moses with Amram and Jochebed being blessed, at least Jochebed, to nurse that boy despite Pharaoh's edict. We're told that Naomi, verse 16 of Ruth 4, took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him a name. Now, we might wonder, who authorized the neighbors to name the baby? I didn't think that's the way it worked then or now. Well, when we keep reading, we find out something. The neighbor women said, "A son has been born to Ruth." No, read that again. "A son has been born to Naomi." So they named him Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then the genealogy continues, and we find out at the end of the story that Israel's greatest king, other than, of course, our God, Israel's greatest earthly king, you could argue Josiah, okay, it's a tie between Josiah and David. His great-grandmother is Ruth. Has Israel been blessed? Does she deserve that blessing? The period of the judges is anarchy. It's complete disrespect and disobedience to God's will. And it's not that God's going to put up with sin. It's not that he's going to allow us to live without penitence and reward us anyway. But his desire that Israel continually be given an opportunity to come back to him is seen in the fact that through the faithfulness of a foreign woman like Ruth, God was still at work in preserving a remnant which would ultimately bless the whole world. We had to go to Matthew chapter 1, verse 5. I used to preach a sermon titled "The Five Shady Women of Matthew 1. I had to retitle it after some thought. But when you think about the women in the genealogy of Jesus, the world had every reason to look at those women and be suspicious, to scorn them and to attack them and to discredit them. But aren't you glad God didn't do that? That God used Tamar and Bathsheba, that God used Ruth, that God was able to even use the young virgin Mary, that God could accomplish in these incredible stories that at first glance in the Old Testament just seem like random events. But then in hindsight, when you get to the beginning of the gospel according to Matthew and you see the pedigree with which Jesus is introduced, and it's easy in that list to focus on Abraham and David as the names that we're most familiar with, that perhaps are made the most bold in the Old Testament. But throughout that genealogy, we see that despite man's best effort, God still did something great. God provides. There's every reason to think that this is not going to have a happy ending. And not everything about the story of Ruth is happy. There are still problems to be dealt with in this book. But ultimately, God is the hero of the story of Ruth, and God is the hero of our story. What are the applications we can make from this? Our needs might look different. Might not be a famine. Might not be dependent upon others like these ladies were. Might not be dealing with the kind of stress and difficult situations exactly. And I can't point at you and list all the needs in your life, but I can give you a list of some needs I have. Some shortcomings, some failures, some hard-heartedness, some blindness, some inability to get it right. Real needs that present themselves frequently. And again, I love Ruth and I love Boaz, and I think character studies have a great place in the church. But if we read this narrative and we fail to see that the real hero, the real reason tonight we can celebrate the fact, is not that Boaz provided, and it's not that Ruth provided. It's that God brought both of these faithful people into our lives through the story of Scripture because God provides. God can use imperfect farmers. God can use Moabite women. God can use an old widow named Naomi. God can use women in a town of Bethlehem, elders in the courtyard of a city, to accomplish tremendous things, not because they've got it all together, but because they simply acknowledge that He's present and in that moment strive to recognize His provision. That's what providence is. I know some people don't really like to talk about providence very much because we can't look out the windshield and see it. But we can sure look in the rearview mirror and see the reality of God's handiwork in our lives if we'll look at that circumspectly. Can we look back in our lives and see the providence of God? Can we write a story, not an inspired story, but can we reflect on decisions that we've made, relationships we've been in, moments in which we stood at a crossroads and despite our best effort, God used us in a way that brought Him glory in our families and our relationships and our work and our service in the local congregation. God provides. I'm not a gloom and doom kind of guy, but this world's a messed up place. And as we reflected briefly this morning, it's easy sometimes to get so caught up in the nature of the world that we fail to give thanks for the nature of God. We see all the problems and we fail to see God's presence. We see brokenness and we fail to give thanks for God's provision. And perhaps just as was true in the period of the judges, now currently with the wars and rumors of wars and the strivings and the division and the hypocrisy and the hurt and the heartache that we see all around us, it's good to pause and to thank God for being present. And perhaps for some of us, to simply recognize that He still provides. Now, it may not be in the timing we want. It may not be exactly what we ask for. It may not be what we expected. But if we really trust God, can't we trust that what He gives us, what He provides for us, is ultimately best? This past weekend, I got together with some friends from college. It's the first time, really, we've been together in nearly 20 years for an extended period of time. And as we were talking about family and just sharing, thinking about memories from the good old days, but also just sharing blessings about our wives and our children and our service in the church and how God's been at work, it was just moving to think about how we don't deserve any of that. But God be praised for being present and for providing. And perhaps, if nothing else, the response to this lesson could simply be gratitude. So that when we approach God in prayer, we're not tempted to make it just a wish list. We begin appropriately by expressing gratitude for the fact that God has poured out these blessings on us. And pray that we'll be better at recognizing these blessings so that even when we're distressed, people will know that that distress is in a context of gratitude, where we recognize that were it not for the provision of God, we would have no hope. We would have no blessings. I don't know necessarily what you're dealing with, but I do know you're not alone. Not only are you surrounded by a family that truly loves you and wants to serve you, under shepherds who want to guide and protect and help you, but we're being blessed in the presence of our God to be the recipients of promises and provision that only God could provide. And tonight, I hope that we'll respond with gratitude. calling on Him rather than trying to fix it ourselves, rather than getting caught up in the bad, focus on the good, not in a Pollyanna kind of way, but just recognizing that if God could work in those days, He can work now, and who knows generationally what will be accomplished simply because we make the decision, God through us at work, to be faithful unto death. If we're Christians, let's embrace that life. If we're not Christians, let's be added to the church in baptism tonight and recognize that our God provides, as together we stand and sing.